Well, hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Good afternoon to everyone. Welcome to Faith Food Friday. This is the second to last one of the season. And thank you all so very much for being here. Before we do introductions, I want to take the time to first and foremost thank the Village Square for always being so great in doing this and great honor to be here in this regard. But I want to give my good friend, Father Tim, a chance to really welcome you. This is our first time in this venue, and so I want to give him a chance as our host today to introduce you all and welcome you.
Father Tim. Hello. Can everybody hear me? Yes. Is it working? It's not very loud. Good. Chaney's got it. Chaney, you got me? You got me?
There you go.
Here you go. Good. Welcome. This is the Co-Cathedral of St. Thomas More. Started in 1967. We serve the FSU campus as a church for the students. We're also a parish, so we have parishioners as well. I've been here for about 6-7 months. It's wonderful. Welcome. Do y'all like it here? Is it nice? Is it okay? We can continue to use this? Is parking easy? Okay, good. All right. Now, if it's not Lent, we'll have meat next time, all right? But we want to... Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you all, and as Father Tim mentioned, this is day 3 of the Lenten season, so those who are observing, they focus. I want to take a chance now, if I can, and introduce those who are here. Let me first introduce our guest panelists, if I may. I'm going to actually read his bio so I don't mess it up. Okay. But to my left, to your right, is Micah Friedman, and Micah is a senior here at Florida State University, majoring in religion with minors in Middle Eastern studies and psychology. In his time at FSU, Micah has served in numerous leadership roles with the Jewish community, bridging religious and cultural divides in the larger community, founding the FSU Student Interfaith Initiative in partnership with Muslim, Christian, and other students, and founding J Street FSU in order to build support for a diplomatic resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so, Micah, welcome. You want to say hello to everyone?
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Happy to be here.
Father Tim, we'll go to you, sir, since you already...
Father Tim, I'm here, Co-Cathedral of St. Thomas More. Great to see you. Welcome.
I am Derek McGee. I pastor Bible-based church on the south side of town, and thank you all for being here. And I have the great honor of being a moderator today. So as you know, it's going to be real fun. To my right?
I'm Josh Hall with First Baptist Church of Tallahassee.
Jack Romberg, rabbi at Temple Israel. And I need to ask, how many FSU... If you're an FSU student, let me see... Your hand, okay. So welcome, FSU students. How many of you were at the Power of We program on Monday night? Any of you? Great. So I want to tell you I was there, and applause to all of you for participating in a wonderful, wonderful program.
And as Jack mentioned, Power We is also a co-sponsor of today's program, so we want to thank them so very much. So today, ladies and gentlemen, our topic is freedom of conscience. And I want to read a quote to you, if I may. Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech. That is a quote from Benjamin Franklin. And so as we go into this topic, we want to have a really great conversation. We're not afraid of debating each other and respectfully disagreeing with each other. Around the 30 minutes after the hour, we'll come out to you as an audience and give you a chance to ask questions of the panel. Any hard questions goes to them, as I am the moderator. So let's go into this. Micah, as our guest, I'm going to ask you the first question, and then I'm going to ask my colleagues to join in on that same exact question, if I may. So the first question is, for you, what does freedom of conscience mean?
A simple question, but also not so simple. Is there a little echo there? Freedom of conscience. The first thing that comes to mind is, what's conscience? What does that mean exactly? And I think your hint was freedom of thought, to entertain ideas that are unique and individual to you as a person. But as a student of religion, I think more of freedom of religion, or a society or social structure that enables people to practice religions of their choosing and of their faith, and does not limit the sorts of religious practices that you can participate in or engage in society. And I also think immediately of a book by John Locke that I read and my studies at Florida State called On Toleration, who is a scholar who, or philosopher, who significantly influenced the ideas of freedom of religion that our country was shaped on. He envisioned a society in which people with different religions could share in society and practice what they believe to be true. Now, what's important to me to acknowledge is that I don't agree with the sort of freedom of religion that he articulated. For John Locke, that meant if you're different Protestant streams, you could all practice. But if you were a Catholic or a Jew, then the things you think, they're not like worth being a part of our society. Actual scholarship of the most influential philosopher when it comes to the thinking of the founding fathers of this country on the question of freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. And he didn't even consider Islam or other traditions as within his writing about whether they should be given freedom of religion within his ideal society. So I think that history demonstrates that freedom of conscience or freedom of faith or freedom of thought has always been this ideal that has been considered and strived for, but also an ideal that hasn't even been envisioned in such a radically inclusive way as we need. I have a hard time thinking about freedom of conscience without considering the ways in which historically it's not been applied to all members of society in fair ways. And I could go on for a long
time. Brother Tim, I'm coming to you, sir.
Okay, I would define freedom of conscience as having the freedom to live where I live and to live my life according to the dictates of my conscience, to be free of any sort of coercion, to act against the principles of my conscience, the moral principles. An example of that would be somebody as a conscientious objector in a war, not being forced to kill and not being forced to participate in something they find morally reprehensible. But I think you touched on something interesting, as you said that John Locke leaves out the Catholics and the Muslims. I mean, this gets to really the point, right, I think, in what we're going to be discussing, is the crisis of values that we have. Because it was very easy for Locke in England to say, well, this is basically a Protestant nation, and so let's talk about toleration. But now we live in a more pluralistic society. And so how do we deal then when we have competing values? What is the source of values? And this is the sort of crisis of values and really a political crisis that we're experiencing in democracies today.
Pastor Josh?
Not much I can add to that other than it. Going to your definition, it's just not being compelled to act against your conscience. Or if we're doing religion, it's not being compelled to act against a conviction or a deeply held conviction. And in this context, by the government.
So we're having a little trouble at the very back of the room. If just everybody could speak up a little bit, hopefully that'll be good enough.
How about now?
We got you, Derek.
Jack?
First of all, I was trying to tell Enam that my wife Audrey is here, so she was right in front of you, that's all. Okay, so, because they're friends. In any case, so for me, I think of freedom of conscience as being free to feel, think absolutely anything. The conflict comes up with, you may feel free to think and believe something, but you have limitations on how you can act on something. And there is the conflict, because there are a lot of things that people believe and think, and a lot of the things that people believe and think that I may radically disagree with. The problem is the limitation or potential limitation on action and the need sometimes to limit action.
Okay, so let's drive right in there. I think we're at a good point now. So let me ask this next question. Can the right of the freedom of thought, conscience, or religion, or belief be limited, and should it be limited?
Just on top of this, James Madison actually proposed, in the Constitution, he proposed, with the addition of religion and speech, a freedom of conscience, and it was rejected. And I'm glad it was, really, because it really does create a quagmire. As much as I believe that we should have the freedom of conscience, how this gets played out legally is messy. If somebody, for example, doesn't want to send their kids to school because they believe schooling is bad? Or how do we interact with these different things? So I do think, legally speaking, this is a murky issue.
Yeah, I'll jump in. So I certainly think that freedom of conscience, freedom of religion can and has been limited throughout history and today. That's simply a fact. There have been innumerable instances of people who've been persecuted for having different sorts of beliefs or practices. And I think that there are contexts in which freedom of conscience should be limited challenged for the sake of protecting higher freedoms, like the right to life, or freedom of agency, freedom to actually be able to do essential things like eat food or live under shelter, some of these more basic needs. So I think a classic example on this issue in American history comes with regard to segregation. There were people who believed with the utmost conviction that people of color, that African Americans should not be allowed to sit in the same restaurants as them because they were white folks, and because of a particular sort of ideology that has some connection to religious ideologies that said that these people don't have the right to come and eat food with me or be in my establishment. Thanks to the action of a lot of people, a lot of disruptive action and political activism, our country decided that there should be a limit to freedom of conscience in that regard, that freedom of conscience shouldn't extend if it shouldn't enable you to actively persecute or discriminate against someone, particularly of a different race. So I think there is and has been limitations of freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, and I think that there should be in instances in which people's more fundamental rights or physically fundamental rights are neglected as a result of someone else's conviction.
So, first of all, I am thrilled, because this never happens or rarely happens, to have another Jew on the panel.
I knew you were going to do it.
Okay.
I knew it was coming.
I'm really pleased with that. Now, typical of having a second Jew on the panel, let me express my disagreement with him. So, number one, I don't believe there should ever be restrictions on thought. That people we cannot police thought. You can police action. You can police, you know, how somebody, you know, brings out that thought into some kind of an action, but you can never police thought. If you try to police thought, then you are going down a path that I don't think this country ever wants to go down. That thought could be horrendous. And yes, the thoughts of segregationists are horrendous. The thoughts of anti-Semites today, completely horrendous. But if we don't allow thought to occur, and if we don't allow those horrendous things to sometimes be expressed, then we cannot properly oppose them, and we cannot properly argue against them. Sometimes it's like squeezing the pus out of a bad boil. Sometimes you have to go through the pain of squeezing that pus out in order to heal. And so freedom of thought is a necessary piece of that. I don't want to limit people's thought. What I want to do is confront them at the times where it's necessary to confront them on that thought.
Can I just say, for a lot of us in here, the graphic we just got from his analogy. Josh, you want to say anything? Because it's going to lead to another question, so I'm going to pull you in the next one.
Yeah, okay. I think where the tension becomes is what are you, because I'm with Michael, what are you grounding, what you're attempting to have these universal transcendent standard, well, what do we ground that in? You know, so if...
What are the sources?
Yeah, right. What's my source of authority by which I say, oh, okay, I'm not going to swallow it.
They want you to eat it.
I'm thinking pus and all this right now. So I'm just in a germaphobe kind of frame of mind right now.
It's a good thing we all agree.
I'm just laying. But it's, you know, what is that source of authority that allows you to say, because I obviously don't disagree with the right to life, but I know what I ground that authority on.
Okay.
You know, so then how do I, in a religiously pluralistic society,
How do I get somebody else who might not, who might have a naturalistic or materialistic worldview and say that we're just atoms bumping into each other? How do I get him to or her to ascribe to or assent to this this value of life? And so it's that's where, because I agree, we can't have carte blanche, whatever you believe, that's what you get to act on. If one believes that child sacrifice is still a legitimate religious expression, probably going to disagree, you know, and you can't have it both ways. Either one's going to be permitted or one's not. What are we grounding that on, I think, is the challenge.
Okay, and there's an example in our recent times of this conflict. There was the woman who refused, after the Supreme Court legalized same-sex unions, to issue marriage licenses. And she was lampooned and made fun of, and on, you know, and I heard all the reasons. You know, she's an agent of the government, so she should enforce the law, right? Most people agree with that. But interestingly, those same people generally are not saying the same thing about cities in our country or states in our country who refuse to enforce immigration law from the government. So it cuts both ways, and that's the thing. I think it's the difficult thing for us, if we're honest with ourselves, what is the real source of values? Again, this is what we come back to. I mean, this might make right. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King demonstrated by allowing himself to be arrested and so on, and his letter from the jail in Birmingham says, you know, it's not, power doesn't make right. Right? And the majority is not always right, and the law is not always right. And there's something different between the law and what is morally acceptable. And this is the tension, I think, that we experience. So we can say, you know, we're okay with limiting someone's conscience, but to what extent? It's a very dangerous thing because our conscience is sacred. It's what makes me ultimately free. And it's something we have to be very careful and delicate when we talk about trampling on someone's conscience for whatever reason. We always have to ask ourselves, is this something okay? And I think we should always err on the side of not doing it.
By the way, the woman who took that position, she has the freedom to think whatever she wants. She has the freedom to go out and say whatever she wants. She has the freedom to say, I disagree with this law. She does not have the freedom as person who is being paid by the government to then refuse to do it, to do her job. Exactly right. Now, in terms of immigration, the same thing applies to immigration officials. And those of us who strongly disagree, and I strongly disagree with the way immigration is going today in this country and the way the direction of things are going, for those of us who oppose it, it's up to us to hit the streets and protest and put on the political pressure to change it the way we want. But at the same time, we cannot expect an immigration official to go against the rules of their job. It's up to us to put on the pressure to change that.
So, Micah, since you are the second youngest up here.
You feel better now, Derek?
I do. Since you're the youngest up here, I want to ask you a generational question, if I may.
Okay.
Same topic. Based on the generation, do you feel as if generations before you misjudge, misunderstand, mischaracterize your generation when it comes to freedom of conscience, freedom of thought, freedom of religion, freedom of expression? Do you see those signs? You think is it intimidation there?
Well, of course. I mean, I think literally every single older generation has misjudged the younger generation in some way, right? Like throughout history, there's always been older people who are saying, look at what the kids are doing. Why are they doing this, right? That's, I think, a universal. I want to just, like, clarify a little bit of what I was saying that I think Rabbi...
Here we go!
Rabbi Jack did some... made a good distinction that I think is important between what happens in your mind, your thought, versus the way that thought expresses itself as action in the world. And, I mean, no one, no state or government or has the authority, right, to influence what happens in your brain or to actually determine, right, certainly an authority to influence, but not to actually determine what your thought is. And I wouldn't for a moment consider that any sort of institution takes any step to prevent people from thinking a certain thing. But I think what's clear is that we do need to take precautions to see how those thoughts manifest themselves in action. Right? Like laws against hate crimes. So, for example, it is illegal for the person who threw a firebomb into the masjid, the mosque, near my family's house in Tampa, to have done that. Even if they believed that that was the right action to take because of some belief about Islam that was probably moved by ignorance, I would say certainly. It's very right for us to have law that prevents that from being acceptable, even though there hasn't been a suspect identified, right? I think this is to some extent in response to your question as well about in a society of pluralistic values, how do we have conversation? I think we can have conversations about what we think God wants, right? But ultimately, we have to have conversations about within the institutions and structures that we are all a part of, how do we come to an agreement and how do we operate, right? So what do we make the law say, right? What do we make the rules look like? So in response to this question about how people are unfairly characterized in my generation, I think there's loads of ways, but one that I find particularly important to talk about, as someone who politically identifies left of center, people often say that the liberals, they all want inclusion and acceptance and tolerance. Unless someone disagrees with them, you know, then they don't like their freedom of conscience if they're saying something that is politically conservative or something of the sort. And I think that that totally is a misunderstanding of, what I feel is important in politics and what I feel is important to express in our society and our institutions because of my faith, because of what I believe that God demands of us. And I believe that God demands of us to pursue equality and justice in society. It says in the Torah that there shall be the same law for you and for the stranger. So I'm not concerned with making sure that everyone feels welcome and acceptable, but with equality and justice. I think it's kind of missing the essence if you say, why can't you just listen to my opinion while I talk about how to suppress someone else's rights? Because ultimately, what I care about is less listening to someone's opinion. And I think a lot of the young folks in the world that I know, millennials and such, care more about equality and justice than about a plurality, than about entertaining opinions that... thoughts that when exercised in action will and have translated to the repression of people's rights in society.
Yeah. So on that same question, let me flip it the other way to us, the older generations than yours. Is there a response to that? Meaning that the millennials have a misunderstanding of...
Josh just told me I'm the older generation, which unfortunately is true. Well, first of all, actually, so here is my response. Micah, if you ever apply to rabbinical school, I will sign on as a reference for you.
Well, thank you.
There it is.
Anybody else?
I don't think they want me signing on, but sure.
Yeah. What about the question?
What do we think about millennials?
No, I asked Micah if he felt like the millennials are misunderstood, that generation are misunderstood when it comes to freedom of conscience from older generations. So I'm asking now, well, you're a millennial.
No.
You're not?
No.
You're Gen X. You're Gen X. So how do you feel
I'm
about the same
I'm on the edge,
question?
But I'm
you
definitely not a millennial. Yeah.
Baby boomer.
Something. No, baby boomer. Whoa.
He's Gen X.
Do you have a response to that, though? Do you feel a misunderstanding by other generations when it comes to your level of freedom of conscience, freedom of thought?
I think all generations are not thinking critically about these issues. I don't think they are. Yeah. And I mean, you said you care more about justice, but I think, what is justice? This has been the age-old question. We just say these words and not really thinking critically about them, reflectively on them. Like, the other day I spoke to an atheist. We were having I was having a beer. I wasn't letting it. And I said, what do you find values? And he said, you know, the Ten Commandments. That's interesting, right? I don't know what he thinks about the first few, but I found it was interesting because we were trying. I said, where is the source of values for you? And he said, he listed a couple of things. I said, well, why do you believe that? He said, it's common sense. Well, that sounds great for us, but it doesn't seem to be common sense in human history. It doesn't seem to be common sense in many countries in this world. So I'd like to know, I mean, we accept these kind of cultural values and norms that we've been kind of inherited or bequeathed by the previous generations, but we're not thinking critically about them. And I think, again, this is our difficulty, because we kind of just assume things like life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, which, by the way, are guaranteed. The authority of them was guaranteed by the fact that we were created by God. That was the basis of Locke's argument. It was the basis of Jefferson's. We obviously don't all agree on that today. So now where do we go to find a source of values that we can all agree on? It's very difficult. And I don't have an answer.
We do have a problem today because, yes, I'm saying this as somebody who's 62 years old, almost 63 years old. So I am the older generation on this panel for sure. And in my lifetime, what I have seen is a change from really kind of knowing what justice is when I was 25 and 30 to I still think I know what it is, but all terms are now under question. And there is now this sense that you can never prove anything really. All scientific conclusions are under question. You can never really prove anything really. But I still feel you can know. I still feel you can know. I mean, I look at justice like pornography, meaning you cannot define pornography, but you sure know what it looks like when you see it. And justice or injustice, maybe we can't always define it, but I sure know what it looks like when I see it. And there are things going on today that, yes, some people may not see them as unjust, and there's where our discussion has to begin.
Again, that's the difficulty. Like, I could say the same thing. I feel like when I see justice, I know it. But I also would say that over the years, and I'm 35, by the way, just to get that out there.
Nice to know you, my son.
I've grown in my understanding of what justice is. It's something that's grown as I've matured and I've encountered things and I've experienced things, especially as I've gotten to know more people, working with poor people and so on. Like, my idea of justice continues, and I have to be open to allowing for me, the Lord, to continue to teach me what justice is. It's not something I understood when I was 5. And I think we have to recognize that. These are good debates to have. And when I said I don't know the answer, I don't know if it's possible for us to come to here's a set of values that are absolute and no one can question. But I think we can move with civility and respect for one another. And that's what I'm saying. We have to tread very carefully on others' rights to conscience. Very careful with that. Whether we think we're right or not, we always must tread very carefully. And sometimes we have to tread, right? We've given some examples of that. But I do think it's important for us to have civility. Real quick anecdote. I'll be very fast. Last, I talked about this at a dinner we had. There was a woman, we had a cake made for a priest. It was his birthday. His name's Father Bernie. He's over at Blessed Sacrament. We put, "Happy birthday, Father Bernie." Well, we get the cake. It doesn't say Father. It just says Bernie. So we're like, where's this at? And she said, oh, well, the woman, she was like a Southern Baptist or whatever, real sweet lady, but she just had a real moral problem with putting Father, because in her faith, you know, the way she reads the scriptures, you're not supposed, it says, Jesus says, don't call any man Father. Right? I joked and I said, "What sewer?" Right? But that's the thing. We would never do something like that. God bless that woman. You know, she's trying to live according to what she believes is right. And I'll go find someone else. I'll write it myself. I'll figure something else out before I go and trample on her and get the law involved to make her do something against what she finds wrong. And I think that's what I'm talking about. We have to have respect for one another and the respect that, you know what, I don't agree with her. And she doesn't agree with me, but how do we live together as a community? And we don't have to just, it's not just might makes right, who happens to be in control at this time. There are some rights that the majority has no right to annul.
And that's where Father Tim and I actually have tremendous agreement that the key to everything is, in terms of pushing the debate forward, in terms of pushing us forward and how we understand, is civility. And that means you have to start with understanding that people are free to think that whatever they're going to think, and that you need to listen to them, and after you listen, then you can respond. But it has to be done with respect, and it has to be done with civility. Otherwise, all it is open hot air with no results.
So we're at the time now, we go to the audience. But before we do, what kind of cake was it?
I don't remember.
You don't remember. Okay. So ladies and gentlemen, if you're here for the very first time, always at this moment in our forum, we always go to the audience, and there is a microphone being handled by Bill Maddox. And here's what happens. Bill holds the mic. All right?
Because Liz tells me to.
And so this is your chance to ask a question. If you want to ask a question to a particular panelist, please make that known, or a general question will be asked. If you want to make a statement, we do ask if you would limit yourself in either one so we can give most people a chance to ask a question or make a statement. Bill?
Where does the, Rabbi Jack, where does civil disobedience meet civility?
That's a great question. Civil disobedience contains a connecting word to civility, okay? Civil disobedience is going into a soda fountain counter in a Woolworths and quietly sitting where you are supposedly not supposed to be sitting because of the color of your skin, and sitting there and quietly ordering your ice cream. That's as opposed to throwing rocks through the window of the Woolworths. That's where I would paint a difference.
I'll come back. I've got one over here and one here.
Could I jump in on that question
as
well, if that's acceptable? So I want to cite a source in Judaism for the virtue of civility and disagreement, which is that in the Talmud, the source of halakha, of Jewish law, there are these two major schools of thought, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. They disagreed on everything. The Talmud teaches us that these disagreements were machlochet l'shem shemayim, disputes for the sake of heaven. And what I think is revealing about this is that their disagreements, they're arguing because they want to actually know what the word of God is, right? They want to actually know how do we build our society and structure our laws so that things are fair. And for me, I think that civil disobedience embodies civility. The core thing needs to be about like what is the goal, right? Whether the goal is to create a society that more upholds the values, and whether those values come from the Ten Commandments or the Talmud or the Quran, or from like atheistic philosophy, right? I think that civil disobedience has a right to take place, and I think that what's indicative about Rabbi Romberg's response is that as long as it's not destroying the property of another, right? So as long as it's not actually infringing upon the civil rights of someone else.
So let me teach this budding student the follow-up to that text, because I just taught it a month or so ago to the board of the Village Square. And that is that the question is asked then, why is most of the law done per the decisions of the school of Hillel,
right,
as opposed to the school of Shammai? The answer is... The answer is because the school of Hillel operated with humility and always acknowledged first the perspectives of the school of Shammai.
Another question here.
Aside from the Holy Scriptures, do y'all believe there are any other sources that you can find to establish values for our society?
Sound like a Josh and Tim question.
Josh, you want to get a response?
I'll tee it up and let the Catholic, because I actually think that natural law is very informative, the sense that there are things that we can learn about how the world operates and how it's intended to operate, and I think that there are some truths that you can derive from that. And the example I'll give is, you know, I can decide that I want to plant an apple tree in Florida and I want to fertilize it with my used motor oil. Give it your best shot. It's not going to work because that's not how the world's designed to work. And I don't recall that God has ever, and speaking of Holy Scripture, ever given a manual on how to grow apple trees. But he's given us the ability to learn and to see what what seems to accord with the natural order, the way that the world is designed to work. So I think that there are truths that you can derive from that. As much as we talk about the diversity, as I understand it, virtually every culture throughout history has had some prohibition of murder. They'll differ on the definition of murder, what's justified, what's unjustified, but I find that interesting, almost as if it's written on their heart. It's an allusion to Romans 1. Almost as if it's written on their heart that there are certain things that are just universally wrong that God has imprinted on us. So obviously, from a Christian worldview, I believe that all of that is true. But even in denying that, even if someone were to deny that, I think that they can still find truth or find some level of truth, even just by being open to looking at what operates within the world. What's the best way for a family to operate, for a society to operate, for to grow orange trees and apple trees?
Tim? Father Tim?
I do. Natural law is a huge part of the Catholic moral tradition. But again, it's difficult to, we say it's murky, it's vague. Not everybody seems to have access to it or something. And I think part of the difficulty is our shift in thinking that took place in about the 16th or 17th century in philosophy to a more technical way of thinking where we become the arbiters of what's true, the deciders of what's true and what's certain and so on. I mean, this is a change in thinking that's occurred. There are other sources. We've seen it. A great book, C.S. Lewis, Abolition of Man. Highly recommended. I've lent it to one or two of you guys out here. He compiles a list of values. And he says you can't question these values and that they are universal. And to question them is to question everything we stand upon. You can't really have a discussion after you get rid of these values. And he interestingly compiles them from cultures and traditions and religions from throughout human history. And he calls it the Tao, like T-A-O, like the...
The way.
Yeah, the way, exactly. So he calls it that. And these were all, like you said, everybody is against murder and so on. But so there is something, I believe, out there. Jefferson called it self-evident. Locke called it self-evident. Maybe it's not so self-evident to some, but I do think we have to have some access to what's right and what's wrong.
I would add to the, first of all, I don't disagree that you can learn and derive from natural law. What I would add, though, is that please don't think that everything we know about natural law currently is the end of the learning process. We are constantly learning new things that kind of changes our perspective on what natural law has to teach us. The existence of the Higgs boson and the Higgs field teaches us a lot more about the nature of the creation of the universe and how it's held together than we ever knew before. So that probably inspires us into different things that we might derive from natural law. Yes, you can derive from natural law, but you have to have an open mind to understand that our understanding of nature, of the science of how the world is put together, is constantly moving forward, constantly changing. And if you don't have that open mind, forget about trying to derive anything from natural law.
Another question here.
With social media the way it is these days, we're in an era where one's conscience is often projected publicly in a frequent sort of way. And lately, especially with the election, we all know what's going on in Facebook and all these things. Where do you stand with regard to civil disobedience and one's conscience if you choose not to march or if you choose not to get out there and publicly display what your thoughts are? Does that necessarily make you in favor of the opposite camp? For instance, I don't like to march. I'm an MS patient. I can't march. But that doesn't mean that because I'm absent from the women's march that I necessarily agree with the opposite side. But I'm accused of that because I refuse to go out there and do what everyone says I should do if I act on my conscience appropriately. So where do you stand on one having the conscience but not necessarily acting on it with regard to social media?
Well, I'm not on social media, so I think it's great. I think like the biggest joke was when everybody was to bring the girls back home from the, you know what I'm talking about?
Nigeria.
This is, I mean, it maybe gives us a feeling briefly of like, I did something great today, but it's really not effective. You know, the problem in this world is not that we don't have enough information. People aren't starving in Africa or in some third world country because we don't have enough Twitter. right? It's not. We have more information now than we've ever had in the history of humanity. And we still, in some ways, our problems are exacerbated. Some of them are better. But that's not the issue. If we're looking to social media as a way to solve this world's problems, we're looking in the wrong place. We need to look in our hearts. That's what I believe.
And he brings up a great point, because we mistake activity with accomplishment. We think that, I posted that on Facebook, that'll fix the world. I think Facebook's record on fixing the world is like 0 in a million, okay? Like, and maybe, raise your hand if you're that, you know, unicorn who has been deeply moved and profoundly persuaded by some tirade that someone wrote on Facebook, but odds are it has more made you entrenched in your own opinion, because they're throwing flames, you know, and it's lacking the civility that we were talking about earlier. So whether it's marching or, and I'm not here to belittle marching or anything like that, but sometimes I think that we just assume just because we're doing something that's making a difference, because we can't stomach the thought of sitting here and doing nothing. But maybe part of the answer is reflecting deeper and trying to find something more impactful to do. And it's a steady theme that we have in these conversations, is being willing to get one-on-one with someone who thinks and feels opposite of you. It's just, you know, to go back to that now cliched starfish analogy of the person throwing the starfish that are all washed up on the ocean, on the seashore, and it's usually a child who's throwing them back into the ocean one at a time, and some wiser person comes along and is like, you're never going to save all of them. What are you doing? You know, what difference have you made? And it's like, I just made a difference for that one. Yeah. And so I think if we're willing to have that mindset of, okay, instead of thinking that I'm going to persuade all of Facebook and my post is going to go viral, maybe I find one person who thinks and feels differently than me, and I'm not even going to tag them in my Facebook post. I'm just going to go have a conversation with them because, you know, something took place in Ferguson or something took place in Washington, and just hear where they're coming from and be willing to be granular and small in our aspirations rather than always thinking that it's going to be sweeping and easy and simple.
St. Thomas More is the patron of this church. He was killed, he was murdered by for his silence. They assumed because he refused to sign the Act of Supremacy of putting Henry VIII ahead of the church that he must have been against it and must have been treasonous. His legal argument was that his silence didn't mean he supported it or disagreed with it. He was just remaining silent, and he was killed for that. So you're in good company.
Bill, can I?
Bill, before you ask that one.
Yeah, I just want to jump on a little bit. So I want to lift up, I think, pieces of the points that you both have made about how changes can be made, significant change can be made on this interpersonal level, right, within the heart and through a conversation with people who are different. And I think that is really important, right? And that it's wrong for folks to say, because you didn't march, you're not, you know, you're complicit in X, Y, Z. Now, at the same time, I don't know, I'm thinking right now about an experience I had my freshman year of high school, where I was in a public school classroom, the only Jewish student, and we were reading Elie Wiesel's Night. Elie Wiesel, probably the most famous Holocaust survivor, and this book's probably the most famous testimony of a survivor's experience. And the framework, the paradigm that we were taught about, was about bystanders and how there were millions of folks who weren't explicitly targeted by the Nazi ideology or program, who did not speak out and oppose the Nazi ideology or program because they weren't targeted and they wanted to, and if they did so, they probably would have been targeted. I was learning in class yesterday about actually a Polish Christian woman who was imprisoned for saying a public prayer for Jews. So I think we have to understand that while just because you don't join a particular sort of action doesn't mean that you're complicit in actually supporting some other form of action that you oppose, for example, I was out of town. I think one of the most horrific things that's happening right now in the United States, that currently we're in a little bit of a limbo, is the huge amounts of anti-Muslim rhetoric and policy that is going on, supported by our president and also many others. And as someone of a religious group that has been targeted in that way, I feel a moral obligation to speak out in opposition to these anti-Muslim actions that clearly, Donald Trump clearly hasn't read the Quran or like looked at the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. That's a side point. But I wasn't able, there was a huge march in Tallahassee. People came from all over the state to express opposition to the recent executive order as this was happening around the country. I wasn't able to be there. I was out of town. So someone could say, look, you're being complicit by not staying there. So I feel it's necessary to do other sort of work. Like right now at Florida State, along with the leader of the Muslim Student Association, we've started a student interfaith initiative where we're not going to be talking about, we're not talking about particular policies we oppose, but we're sitting down and saying, so you're Muslim, what does that mean to you, right? You're a Christian, what does that mean to you? Or you're an atheist, what does that mean to you? And there's, I've had some incredible moments of learning, and I know that people from all of these backgrounds have. So I think that it's important for us to expand our understanding of what it means to resist something you disagree with, and for people who are engaged in that work to not blame someone for not joining in. And I think it's really important that we understand the sort of like horrible targeting of vulnerable minorities that we're experiencing right now, especially for this faith panel of people of a particular faith background.
Bill?
I had one like small point, and then I had a perspective that I wanted to hear everybody on the panel kind of react to. The small point I had is regards to Kim Davis earlier and then the immigration thing. That's different because of the complications of states' rights versus the federal government kind of structure, so that's just a small point. But the perspective I had was kind of the answer to what are we grounding ourselves on. I think both Tim and Josh brought up what's the moral authority. And it's funny, Josh, you appealed to kind of like natural law and history. I think this is kind of the direction to go where history shows people will kind of decide for themselves in a time period and in an area what moral law is. So the answer, what is justice, is kind of like, instead of the marketplace of ideas, it's a battle place of ideas. People are fighting for what does that mean in any given area or in any given time period. And so I think, I mean, I'm interested in your perspective on this kind of idea of justice. Do you think that's something that makes sense? Whatever justice is just kind of battling it out. And Jack mentioned like civility, and that kind of helps, honestly, if you're trying to coerce people or convince people, it helps to be civil about it, but I guess I'm asking, are you acknowledging or could you acknowledge that justice is kind of this subjective thing that everybody comes together and gets to decide?
The first danger I have with that is, and we don't have to go back 100 years, we can name some things that our society had decided were just, and today we've decided it's not just. And so my question would then be, objectively, was it just then and it's unjust now? Or was it unjust then, even though society had collectively determined that it was tolerable and just? I mean, we're mentioning segregation earlier. So just use that as an example. Either it was, you know, my framework would be, if it was wrong then, it's wrong now, regardless of what the ballot box or the collective tolerance of society was. And so that's what I think is always the challenge of trying to vote about what is morally right and morally just. I think, again, this is where my faith informs public policy. I think we should try to shape society towards what is just. And that's why, again, you hear us talking about having something to frame and to ground that on. So now I know what I'm trying. That's the plumb line to which I would love to see society aligned in terms of determining what is just. But that is the challenge if you're taking away that objective, relatively speaking, that objective of a plumb line. What are you using that doesn't just go down to pure mob democracy of might and or numbers make right?
I agree, yeah. I think the majority... Well, first, to go back to your first point, it is a complication between state and federal law, but immigration is a federal issue. And so was the Supreme Court made the definition of marriage a federal issue, and so it made her responsible for issuing marriage licenses, and one could just make the same argument. I mean, the point was people would not be critical in the same way of those who are in a opposition to immigration, for example. Wouldn't be wouldn't have the same critique for those cities or mayors or whoever is responsible for not enforcing it as they normally do for someone like that woman. You knew her name, which is impressive. Good for you. Yeah, good man. The second point you're bringing up, If I asked you a question, I mean, the fact is it's not just all subjective. And I don't think anyone really believes that. We say those things sometimes when it suits us, but I don't think any of us believe that. I don't think there's a single real, true moral relativist here in this room. If I asked the question, is it always wrong, always morally unacceptable to rape and kill and torture a baby? Is there anybody here who would disagree with that? So there must be values, and they're not just determined by what we feel or think. It's always morally wrong. Unless you disagree, I'd like to hear it. Right, but by saying, I'm not saying that they're right. I'm saying that they were wrong. I'm saying that the people who owned slaves in the South were wrong. I'm not saying that they were, well, they were right then. No, they weren't right then. They were wrong then. And that's why we had a war. That's why we have laws. This is why we have elections and so on. Do we believe, is it just power? Or is it just, you know, no, I think there's actually rights. I think there's actually values. I think they are real things.
I want to lift up just a piece of this, if I can, which is that I think that it's fundamentally important for any of us who have a sense of what's right or what's just to fight for what we think is right and just, right? And to, like, to enter, I think, the public battleground around what it is, right? I think that's what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, is that this is unjust, and so I'm going to fight against it, despite the fact that other people thought it was just. So I think there's a lot of truth to the reality that we live in a battleground when it comes to what's right and what's just.
Bill?
Against the backdrop of the legal attack on Hobby Lobby over abortifacts, the fining to death of a pastry shop owner, the threatening of professional licensure for doctors and pharmacists over what procedures they may perform or what drugs they may dispense. Are we winning or losing the battle for freedom of conscience?
Man, it's a great question. So glad I'm moderating today. It's a really good question.
We're neither winning or losing it. We're just continuing the fight. I think that there's always going, that people are always going to think what they're going to think. There's always going to be disagreement. The battle that we can win is trying to make sure that these discussions occur in a certain kind of a way, and that a certain type of, It's really hard for people on different parts of the ideological spectrum to show respect for the person on the other side. I mean, I read all the time of conservatives condemning liberals and liberals condemning conservatives. Conservatives say liberals are just Eastern elites and you know, with no moral grounding, and liberals say that conservatives are just racists and bigots, and, you know, these kind of things just get put out there. And what we have to do is force ourselves to step back from those stereotypes and then start to listen and then start to have the conversation. That really is what it's about. If you try and parse out into anything else, you're just going to go down an ideological rabbit hole of which you'll go through the looking glass into a place that you can never get out of. It really begins with understanding that no matter how horrible you think that person's perspective is, you got to sit and listen to it first, and then you can engage. You just got to be able to engage in a respectful way, and only then, after you form maybe some kind of a tie or relationship with that person or an understanding of each other, can each of you start to move. Now, I do think, and, you know, all right, maybe at 62 I'm still an optimist or a cross-eyed optimist or whatever the phrase is, but I actually think that despite setbacks that occur from time to time, and I think right now in terms of the progression of understanding justice and liberty and freedom, that we are on a step back. But I say that with the sense that I have seen history go like this. We have moments of pushing ahead and moments of stepping back. But I think we keep moving forward as we learn more and more, and our goal needs to be open to listen, because that's only how it gets resolved.
We have time for one more.
Can I ask a real quick follow-up to this question? I want to ask it of our millennial guest, and that's this. Do you find that the language of conscience is more accessible to people of your generation than the language of religion? Because a lot of the examples that were just cited were examples of people who, for religious reasons, had a problem doing something. And yet, when I reflect on the inauguration recently, I was troubled by what by dancers in the Rockettes who did not want to participate in a ceremony, an inauguration ceremony for Donald Trump, as well as a singer who was part of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir who, for political reasons, did not want to participate in inauguration ceremonies for Donald Trump. Those, to me, were they were saying, this violates my conscience. And those, to me, seemed like examples that a lot of my secular, non-religious, millennial kids and friends could understand in a way that maybe they couldn't appreciate the baker or the florist who said, I can't participate in a ceremony that violates my conscience over here. So I'm just curious to know, do you think conscience is terminology that helps with your generation?
I think it's a really interesting question. And gets at something really, really important. I don't know that conscience is such accessible language either. Maybe that's a reflection on our school systems or something. Because we're not taught about freedom of conscience. I didn't learn about freedom of conscience in that language until I got to the religion department at Florida State. But I do think that what you're hitting at is some problem in the way that we understand religion. So I'm in a seminar right now that's required to graduate with a degree in religion at Florida State about what is religion, what does the word religion mean. I would argue that there are religious elements to the ways in which people have political convictions, and that people deserve the freedom to act in the way that they conscientiously think about those ideological commitments. I think that freedom of conscience perhaps describes the sort of freedom that we're going for, that we want, better than freedom of religion. But there's a lot more, I would urge people to do a lot of critical thinking about what you mean when you mean religion, what you're referring to with that word, and what you're referring to when you refer to the word conscience. Because the word religion was, it's defined primarily by, Protestant Christian folks, and the definitions of religion don't always, go to other things that are, could be seen quite clearly as religious in character. Elsa, stop there, yeah.
Then we have time for one more question.
I just point out one thing as you're walking over there. Why? I don't see how religion should be disqualified from being a reasonable thing to take a stand on any more than anyone else. I mean, what other thing is there to take a stand on? That's what I'd be questioning.
Bill, our last question.
Okay, what happens when...
Reason is based on, you have to have values. You can't come up with values from reason. $1,000, I've offered it before, I offer it again. Go on.
What happens when having people follow their conscience can endanger others' lives? And what comes to mind is the vaxxer, anti-vaxxer debate that has gone on for, I don't know, quite some time.
Vaxxer?
I'm sorry, vaccinations.
Oh. So this is our last question. I'll give... I don't know who on the panel wants to respond.
Well, I think we've said that there has to be some limitations on actions. Okay, it's one thing to think, but there has to be limitations on actions. The whole vaccine thing began with misinformation. I saw my own daughter go through, to my own frustration, I saw my own daughter go through this when our first grandchild was born, that because it had just come out that certain vaccines cause autism, she was reluctant to have her daughter vaccinated right away. And, I did a little bit of research and talked with some doctors and found that that was nonsense. And finally, she came around. So most people came around. It's a very tiny group that is insisting. And, we can't change her mind, but as, yes, but you can just keep trying to give them the facts.
So, Jack, since you have the mic and we're at that time, you have two announcements.
Yeah, I wanted to give two announcements. Number one is on March the 25th, and I've talked about this before. You maybe have heard the publicity on it. March the 25th, a joint project between the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra, the Holocaust Education Resource Council, and Temple Israel, is presenting a story of the spiritual defiance of Jewish prisoners in the concentration camp in Theresienstadt, how they express their spiritual resistance by learning Verdi's Requiem Mass. We're going to tell that story. The Mass will be performed along with some other pieces of music. We're going to really have imagery of that corresponds with the story. It's going to be a really beautiful evening. If you have not gotten your tickets and you would like to go on March 25th, I urge you to go, because in today's world of divisions, this story of how a Catholic Mass inspired Jewish prisoners, I think, is a really important story to hear. So just call the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra office or go on their website and you can get your tickets. The second, a less serious, but maybe serious too, the Jewish Food and Cultural Festival is April 9th at Temple Israel, and you can go online on our website and pre-order your corned beef and pastrami sandwiches right now.
And also, I wanted to say thank you really briefly to FSU's Power of We project that co-sponsored this program today.
Thank you very much. And as we prepare to leave, I want to again say thank you to our guest panelist, Micah. Thank you for being here. Micah graduates from FSU in May, and he's planning on going to rabbinical school. So thank you so much for making time to be here to my